Chapter 45, The History of Ancient Philosophy. Section A, The Historical Setting of Christianity. Ancient philosophy is the classical philosophy of Greece and Rome, the effort of reason alone to know the ultimate explanations of reality. It is particularly relevant for theology, since Christianity was born in the cultural area of the Roman Empire. The early Christians had to explain the faith to the pagans living in Greco-Roman culture, and in so doing, they had to give answers to the questions asked by those people. It is therefore important for us to know their philosophy. Divine revelation is not a philosophy. It did not receive any influence from any human source, but came directly from God. However, in developing the faith, the theologians used concepts which were there already. For example, those people in the Roman Empire knew very well that all men look for happiness, but they did not know how to attain it. Christian revelation would answer this question by saying that there is one God who is Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, and that there is a divine plan of salvation for man, whereby man will really attain happiness. The concept of happiness was already in their minds, and it is important to know what they usually understood by it, or by any other vital reality. We should know their philosophy, then, not because it had any influence on Christian revelation, but because the theologians had to use concepts which the pagans already had, and then perfect them. These achievements of classical philosophy were used as instruments for the theology which was elaborated by Christian teachers, and this applies to all Christian theologians in those Christian centuries we have mentioned. Most of those concepts were taken from three main sources: 1. Plato, 2. Aristotle, 3. Neoplatonism. We shall examine them one by one, because they were the main sources not of Christian thought, but of that Christian philosophy which was needed to explain the faith. In most cases, the elements which theologians took from these pagan sources were improved and perfected, and they were always truths of natural philosophy, not just cultural ideas or subjective interpretations. Whenever theologians accept something from Plato, for example, it was not because it was from Plato, but because it was true. Truth is not something that can be nationalized, since it belongs to all cultures and races, to all men. That is why it is incorrect to say that Christian theology is Hellenistic or Greek or Western. It is simply true. Truth is above all those differences of climate or nation. The Christian theologian who accepted these truths reached by pagans accepted them as truths of natural philosophy, but they improved them, purified them from errors, making them clearer by comparing them with divine revelation, i.e., with the truth communicated by God. So, when we get to know some of those philosophers like Plato and Aristotle, we are in a better position to understand Christian writers, especially the metaphysics of St. Thomas, because the great achievement of St. Thomas is precisely that he took some of the best insights of Plato and Aristotle, improving them and synthesizing them, as we saw in chapter 16, section B. However, these philosophies give rise also to heresies, because of their mixture with errors. This too makes it important to know them, because error usually recurs, and so we can better trace it by knowing those sources. Section B, Plato, 427 to 348 BC. From the dates, we can see that Plato lies astride the 5th and 4th centuries BC, the golden age of the political life of Athens. His deep interest was the life of man and society, insofar as society could help man to reach his transcendent destiny beyond this life, the happiness of man. He was educated in Athens under Socrates, who could not accept the current philosophy of the Sophists, intellectuals of their time, a philosophy which consisted in the rejection of truth. They did not believe in truth, but only in appearances, in how one sees things, not in what they are in themselves, and that everything is in a state of flux and there is nothing permanent. For them, the important thing in life was to get ahead, to succeed, getting as much satisfaction as possible. Socrates rejected this entire philosophy as contrary to reason, since reason demands something stable and permanent. See chapter 6, section E. He managed, with his manner of philosophizing, to force the sophists to admit that their rejection of the truth implied a self-contradiction. If one says that there is no truth, either he is telling the truth or not, and in either case, he contradicts himself. Socrates was firmly convinced that man is intelligent, that he differs from animals, and so he rose against the philosophy of the sophists. Plato was one of his disciples, and when Socrates died, he traveled to southern Italy, which was also part of the Greek-speaking world, where he experimented his political theories, though not very successfully. Then he returned to Athens, where he founded his school called the Academy, after the god Akademos, in which he taught his philosophy. He wrote in the form of dialogues, with a very readable style, more literary and poetical than scholarly. Here is a sketch of his doctrine. 1. Ideas are the principles of all things. 2. The sensible world participates in the ideas. 3. Human souls fulfill themselves by the contemplation of the ideas. 4. Morality, education, and politics consist in communicating this contemplation to others. Let us now briefly develop these 4 points. First, the ideas. We observe in the world certain realities like beauty, justice, goodness, etc., which are always found in fragmentary and scattered ways. We don't find beauty as such, but beautiful things. Not justice as such, but actions. Not goodness as such, but good men, etc. These realities are found in the world, fragmented, i.e., piece by piece, not in their fullness. So, they must exist, he said, by themselves, in another world, topos uranus, equaling a place in heaven. Because, if we see images, there must be a model, archetypos. These are the ideas of forms, eidos, the models of all things. For everything that we can define, Socratic influence, there must exist an idea in that world of ideas. And these things we see around us participate in or imitate the pure ideas. There seem to be 2 worlds, the world of things, sensible, and the world of ideas, intelligible. But the latter is the fundamental world according to Plato, while the other is only a participation or imitation. As we saw in chapter 16, St. Thomas hailed the idea of participation, but pointed out that Plato did not realize that reality is in the act of being, not in the form as such. Platonic metaphysics is therefore defective, since Plato was looking only at forms or ideas, but without actuality of being, these ideas are only abstractions and don't exist by themselves. Aristotle, on the other hand, understood that these ideas are only abstractions from reality, but then he said that the real thing is the world of motion, which is not entirely true either. The real world is that of actuality of being, which includes the world of motion. Participation, then, should be understood in this sense, that everything exists or has the act of being, participates in the act of being because it limits the act of being to what the thing is. And this implies the existence of a pure act of being, which is not participated but is the fullness of the act of being. This is how the metaphysics of St. Thomas brightens the dimness of Platonic metaphysics. See chapter 16, section B. As for the human soul, Plato says that it is made for the contemplation of the ideas in which its happiness is found. He first proves the existence of the human soul, and then its immortality. But he goes too far and proves also the pre-existence of souls, which is already an error. See chapter 31, section B. The human soul is indeed immortal, but it does not exist before the body. He falls into this error because he conceives the human soul as a being in itself, a complete substance, which is like the motor of the body. For him, man is a soul using a body. Aristotle, on the other hand, while realizing that the soul is the substantial form of the body, emphasizes the substantial union of body and soul so much that he can hardly see the immortality of the soul, and prefers not to discuss it. St. Thomas gets the best of both, all the positive from Plato for the immortality of the soul, plus the hylomorphism, matter and form doctrine, of Aristotle, which shows very clearly the unity of body and soul, and why the soul cannot exist before the body, as it is its substantial form. But when the body dies or disintegrates, the soul goes on living, since it is spiritual in nature. It performs the spiritual operations of understanding and choosing, and so it cannot disintegrate, as it is not material at all. This is why it is fitting to think that the bodies will rise again, since the soul is incomplete without the body, even if it can go on living by itself. Another Platonic error is to think that everything has a soul, not only man. There are souls everywhere. Everything is animated. He held this belief from the Pythagoreans, very similar to Hindu beliefs, reincarnation of souls, etc. He believed that every planet or celestial body had a soul too, because it moved, and the soul is the principle of motion. Aristotle was more correct in conceiving the soul, psyche, as the principle of immanent motion or of life. There are many kinds of souls as degrees of life, and the spiritual life of man requires a kind of soul which cannot inform anything but a man. See chapter 31. Lastly, for Plato, morality, education, and politics consist in communicating the contemplation of ideas to others. We said earlier, see chapter 21, section C, that in studying the history of philosophy, it is always important to see what philosophers say about God. For Plato, God is the supreme soul or intelligence and the origin of all motion. But he also calls gods the other intelligences which are under that supreme one. These are the intermediary beings identified with the celestial bodies, which are also animated by superior souls. These celestial bodies are somehow related to our lives, hence the belief in astrology or horoscopes, in some beings up there in the sky who rule our lives. This is one more form of that determinism which we discussed in chapter 30, section C. But the contemplation of the ideas, the soul resembles God more and more. In order to achieve this, man must be righteous in this life. And this is the beginning of that life of contemplation, of the ideas which we will receive after this one. And what about evil? Evil, he says, is the punishment for error, and consists in being embodied again, i.e. reincarnated. In chapter 31, we have already discussed these errors and the path of truth they contain. See also chapter 38, section E, for the correct notion of moral sanction. Section C, Aristotle, 384 to 322 BC. As a young man, he came under Plato's influence when he went to Athens and joined the academy. He sympathized with Plato on many points, but there was one on which he disagreed, namely, where reality is. For him, reality is in the sensible world, not in the world of ideas. Raphael has immortalized this in his fresco, representing an old Plato pointing his index finger upwards, facing a young Aristotle pointing it downward. Thus, Aristotle eventually left the academy and set up his own school, which he called Lyceum, where he taught the natural sciences. In the academy, on the other hand, the teaching was based rather on mathematics as more ideal, while the natural sciences are about real things. In fact, Plato denied that there could be such sciences. Aristotle made many notable contributions to them, especially in biology. For Aristotle, we have to start with the material world, i.e. the world of motion, of things that move. Now, the principle of a thing that moves is called in Greek physis, hence physica, equaling things that move. Motion here means not only change of place or linear motion, but any change, like the growth of a flower or a step in the reasoning process. Then, from physics, he goes to metaphysics. Although he did not actually use this word, it was coined 2 centuries later, when his books were compiled to designate the books that came after the physics, meta equaling after. However, St. Thomas remarked that this term was well chosen, since metaphysics deals with what is beyond physics. And thence he goes to logic, which is our manner of knowing reality. Logic comes from the Greek logos, which means thought, although originally it means gathering into one what is scattered, which is what we do when we think, when we form our concepts. Our concept of animal, for example, is one, but it is formed out of many kinds of animals. Logic, then, is the science of thought. And finally, for Aristotle, the most important knowledge to acquire comes at the end. After studying physics, metaphysics, and logic, we are prepared to tackle ethics and politics, which is the most valuable knowledge because it deals with the happiness of man and society. Now let us summarize the main points of Aristotle's doctrines under 5 headings. 1. Physics. 2. Metaphysics. 3. God. 4. Man. 5. Ethics. 1. In physics, he says that there are 2 kinds of changes in material things. A. Changes which do not alter the substance, since they are only accidental, and B. Real substantial transformations. This leads him to discover that bodies are composed of 2 principles, the matter, principle of undifferentiation, and the form, principle of differentiation. The former underlies the changes, and the latter determines them. The Greek for matter, or common stuff, is hyle, and for form, morphe, hence hylomorphism, or matter and form doctrine. This is one of the most valuable achievements of natural philosophy, and fully acceptable to Christian philosophy, which has used it extensively, for example, in sacramental theology. The same applies to the substance and accidents doctrine, which has multiple applications in theology. When the Church uses these concepts in her dogmatic definitions, however, it is not as Aristotelian concepts or Greek concepts, but as real metaphysical concepts mirroring realities in full view of all men, of all ages, of all cultures, of all places. That, for example, a thing cannot become something else unless it has the ability to do so, act and potency doctrine, is a truth which is above all differences of time and place. Aristotle discovered that motion is something very real, contrary to what Plato and others thought, who said that change is a sort of illusion, that the only thing that is real is what does not change. Aristotle explained the realities of change or motion as an act, though imperfect, i.e., an act in the process of passing from potency. Thus, he defines motion as the act of a being which is still in potency, for as long as it is still in potency. See Chapter 7, Section B and C, Chapter 13, Section A, and Chapter 14, Section B. And then he also discovered that time is the measure of motion. There are things that move, and the measure of that movement in respect of the before and the after succession is called time. Another Aristotelian discovery is quantity, as the first accident derived from matter, but distinct from corporeal substance, which is also a very important metaphysical truth for theology. See Chapter 13, Section A and B. On the other hand, Aristotle fell also into Plato's error of thinking that celestial bodies are also animated, which highlights the difference between what is conditioned by culture and therefore dated, i.e. either out of date or up to date, and what is true regardless of culture. And the test to tell the difference is the candid observation of reality, without allowing the imagination or the emotions to distort the view. See Chapter 9, Section E. 2. Aristotle conceives metaphysics as the science of the first cause, and of being as being, and the properties of being. We have followed this conception and approach in Parts 3 and 4, as well as in Part 2, Chapter 7, and we have seen how acceptable it is to a Christian philosophy. Among Aristotle's other discoveries in metaphysics, we can mention A. the principle of non-contradiction as first principle of being, B. the analogy of being, C. the 10 categories of being, 1 substance and 9 accidents, D. act of potency, E. the 4 causes, formal, material, efficient, final. We can say, therefore, that Aristotle is the greatest metaphysician before Christianity. 3. However, his idea of God is also imperfect, like Plato's, but still remarkably lofty, taking into account that the Greeks were polytheistic. It is an achievement for Plato to have conceived of one God, monotheism, even though he also calls God the intermediary beings. Even though he also calls gods the intermediary beings, as we saw. But Aristotle went further than Plato by conceiving God as the first mover and the first cause, and calling him pure act. Furthermore, he conceived God as the final cause. However, he did not see God as the efficient cause of the movements taking place here in the universe. For him, God is only the first mover. But then, all subsequent motions go by themselves. See Chapter 18, Section D. Thus, he also rejects divine providence. See Chapter 24, Section G. 4. On the topic of man, Aristotle surpasses Plato again. As we have seen, he regards the human soul as the substantial form of the body, which rules out reincarnation. His consequent difficulties about the immortality of the soul were dispelled by St. Thomas, as we saw in Chapter 31. Another achievement of Aristotle in this respect is his study of the sensitive life and the intellectual life in man. In the former, he deals with the external and internal senses, and with the emotions or passions, see Chapter 27, Section A, and Chapter 29, Section A. And in the intellectual life, he distinguishes between the active and passive intellect, and masterfully describes the process of abstraction, see Chapter 27, Section B. 5. Lastly, in Ethics, he is concerned with the happiness of man in society. All men seek what is good, and what is the best thing for man? His classical answer is that the good proper to man must be the best act of his best potency bearing upon the best object, which is found in the contemplation of God and the practice of the virtues of the intellectual life. See Chapter 34, Section D, Chapter 38, Section F, Chapter 39, Section G, and Chapter 40, Section A. But since man lives in society, he must also practice the virtues needed for his living together with other men. Prudence first, and then justice, fortitude, and temperance. So this is Aristotle, great achievements and some errors. Other errors, that slavery is part of the natural law, and that the state has the right to limit population growth. As we said, St. Thomas hailed his philosophy, but he purified it from its errors and perfected it. For example, regarding act and potency, St. Thomas made use of these concepts in a way that went well beyond what Aristotle had ever conceived. Aristotle never thought of the act of being, actus essendi. His vision was confined to the physical world, while for St. Thomas, actuality means, above all, actuality of being, a more metaphysical vision. Aristotle's incomplete vision prevented him from seeing God as acting on everything. See Chapter 24, Section F. Aristotle conceived God as the first mover, but outside the world, because of his defective concept of act, which is more physical than metaphysical. What St. Thomas did was to take this concept and raise it to a metaphysical plane, and then he combined it with Plato's concept of participation. But he did all this under the guiding light of the faith, since it is the Bible that describes God as He who is, Exodus chapter 3. He saw that God is the fullness of being, the very act of being, the perfection of being, the subsistent act of being, and everything else is a participation in the act of being, which must be created by God out of nothing, since God cannot share his infinite act of being. See chapter 4, section B, chapter 16, section B, chapter 18, section D, chapter 23, section A, and chapter 24, section E. Section D, Neoplatonism. This is the most influential philosophy in the so-called period of Hellenism after Aristotle. The political crisis following the dismemberment of Alexander's empire sank the Greek world into a mood of pessimism, expressed in esoteric religions and moral philosophies of salvation, such as the fatalism of the Stoics and the hedonism of the Epicureans. Neoplatonism, the strongest of these movements, was a combination of Plato and Aristotle. It originated with Philo of Alexandria, a contemporary of Christ, see previous chapter, and reached its peak with Plotinus in the 3rd century AD. Christians found in it some elements which could be accepted, like its concept of the transcendence of God, and other elements which had a negative influence. And we can also say that both these kinds of elements came one way or another from either Plato or Aristotle. The Neoplatonist tradition extended well into the Christian centuries and affected Arab philosophy also very deeply. The gist of it is that all beings proceed from the One in a graded hierarchy of perfection. But how this procession or emanation takes place can be interpreted in many ways, hence the errors of some Neoplatonist Christians regarding such doctrines as the Blessed Trinity and creation. On the other hand, some of the best insights of Plotinus had a deep impact on St. Augustine, as we shall see, and St. Thomas Aquinas accepted all true achievements of Neoplatonism, such as the hierarchy of participation in being and the absolute transcendence of God. In our next chapter, we shall see more aspects of the influence of Neoplatonism on Christian thinkers.